You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Some years back, discussions in the legislature centered around a recent report by Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which found that ignition interlock devices in California have prevented over 1 million instances of drinking and driving since the year 2010. As a result of these discussions, in 2016, the state enacted legislation that went into effect early this year. It simultaneously promises to give violators the ability to drive, while at the same time promises to keep us all safer. Tonight, we discuss that legislation and how it changes the paradigm, and whether such a win-win is at all possible. Are we really safer? If it happened to you, what do you do when you get pulled over or pick up a DUI case? Just how does one handle a DUI? On the program tonight with me via telephone is Redwood City Attorney Nafiz Ahmed. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you may call regarding any question on the topic of driving under the influence. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in the conversation. Mr. Ahmed is returning to join us once again and is particularly generous with his time in participating on this program. And with that, Nafiz, let me welcome you back to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, Jeff. How you doing? Good to be back with you again.
Well, we're very glad to have you. You know, before we go further, I'd like to start with this. You know, to be honest, a DUI can be both one of the more dangerous acts one can commit in their life, and yet it seems many, if not most, of the people that are so charged are regular folks. They're not our criminally minded folks, but rather people you might meet otherwise in a normal your normal life. Is this your experience as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, my practice is focused primarily on criminal defense, which is broken up between criminal crimes, non-DUI versus DUI crimes, and it's split about 50-50. And the thing that I notice in my DUI practice is that I get clients from all walks of life, but I would say predominantly, you know, from the workers here in Silicon Valley, you know, the folks who have, you know, good paying jobs who just happen to be out drinking and getting stopped by the police, whether it's on 101 or 280 or somewhere in the you know, local peninsula cities on their way back home. So yeah, I find that, you know, my clients, you know, generally are employed, have good jobs, and it's probably their first offense.
Many of our listeners might have strong feelings about what penalties should befall a DUI driver, but focusing on the licensure effect, the effects on your driving ability, your ability to support your family or maybe even make restitution, can you talk a little bit about what was the paradigm before this law changed?
Yeah, so pretty much what the law had been, you get a DUI anywhere in the state of California as a first-time offender. What was going to happen if you ended up with your license suspended was that you were going to have a minimum period of 30 days in which you could not drive, like, period. There was a blackout period of 30 days at a minimum on a first DUI, and it was only after that 30-day time period elapsed that you could then get a restricted license that would allow you to drive to and from work during the scope of work and then to a DUI program. But it wouldn't let the driver drive anywhere else. So the driver couldn't drive to the grocery store. They couldn't drive to pick up their kids from school or to go to the doctor's. That was essentially you know, the paradigm up until 2019.
And what most of our listeners might not know is you don't have to be convicted of a DUI to have that happen to your license, do you?
No. There's two ways to get your license suspended. One is through the Department of Motor Vehicles, and one is with the court. And when we're talking about convictions, we're generally talking about getting convicted of a DUI in court. But aside from the whole court aspect, if an individual gets their license suspended by the DMV, which, you know, there's a whole set of rules about that I'm sure we could get into later in the program, if they get their license suspended by DMV, that's something that would have triggered that 30-day period in the past where you couldn't drive at all before you're eligible for the restricted license.
Now, can you prevail in court and still lose your license to the DMV?
You can. Just want to say one thing quickly about the new shift in 2019, just to finish that thought really quickly. In 2019, what the benefit of the new law is, and this is going to really help folks, is instead of having to deal with this 30-day blackout period where they can't drive at all, what ends up happening now is if the person who's been arrested for a DUI puts what's called an ignition interlock device in their car, and they do certain other things like attend a DUI school, have increased policy limits for their insurance, and pay DMV a certain amount of money, a nominal amount, about $125. If they do those things, then the individual can drive with this ignition interlock device in their car, and they can drive anywhere. So now the individual who's arrested for a DUI in 2019 and beyond, they can drive without restrictions, and they don't have to suffer that 30-day blackout period. So I just wanted to say that. That's the new law, and that's a major benefit, okay? Different rules with respect to whether it's a first, second, third, or felony DUI or DUI with injury, et cetera. So just wanted to throw that out there. Going back to your last question, Jeff, it was, can you basically beat a DUI in court yet still end up with a license suspension? Yes, the crazy thing is you can. Because the DMV and the court are completely separate, the DMV can suspend your license even if you win in court. However, depending upon how you win in court, you may be able to get your DMV suspension set aside. There's a lot of technicalities and rules that go along with that I could explain, but in a nutshell, you could get your license suspended at the DMV even if you win at court. But you may be able to, avoid a license suspension completely if you do win at court.
So you've actually gotten ahead of my next question, which I was going to ask you what's changed this year. But does this really keep us safer, in your opinion?
Safer, that's a great question. I don't really see it from the law enforcement side, and I don't really have all the statistics. You would think, though, that having the ignition interlock device... So what this does, okay, for people who don't know what an ignition interlock device is, I'm going to explain to you right now. It's basically a machine that gets installed in the vehicle, and it detects whether or not there's any breath alcohol or in the person who's blowing into the device. And the ignition interlock device, won't start the car if there's any amount of alcohol detected in the person's breath. So theoretically, somebody who is attempting to get behind the wheel with any amount of alcohol in their system won't be able to drive. From a big picture point of view, yeah, theoretically, if you're, putting an ignition interlock device in the cars of, most offenders who get, a DUI, then yeah, it should keep everyone safer. Although the interesting thing that I'm going to point out is an ignition interlock device is not mandatory on a first DUI. It's not mandatory. But most people are going to voluntarily choose to install it so that they can avoid this whole, license suspension, the 30-day license suspension issue. of course, there may be some people who get a DUI and choose to, you know, not install the device, not have a valid license, and go ahead and drink and drive anyways. And those are probably the ones who are going to put society at the greatest amount of danger. So whether there's a requirement for ignition interlock device or not, I'm not, you know, sure it's going to help that much. But in theory, it should help.
One thing I learned only in the last couple of days is, contrary to what most people, even most attorneys, believe, these devices don't stop working once you've started the car. They come on at random times while you're driving. Can you talk a little bit about that? What happens if you aren't able to blow in the device or it detects alcohol and you're driving down the freeway?
So my understanding is, I think the intervals are about 15 to 20 minutes apart, something like that, before you have to blow into the ignition interlock device again. And I think that your vehicle, if you fail to blow, will be disabled. And I think that's essentially, you know, how it works. If you don't end up blowing into, you know, the device, theoretically, I think the vehicle should be disabled.
So if the MAD study holds true and works prospectively as it did at the time of the study, presumably people won't be drinking and driving. Even if people are driving that might not have driven before, at least they're not going to be driving with alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, there's also, you know, potential ways, you know, people talk about getting around it. Like, what if you have a passenger in the car and, you know, they're sober? I mean, but then again, you know, why would you have a sober person, you know, be a passenger and not driving if you're drunk? But I mean, theoretically, there's ways around it. But yeah, big picture, yes, it should be working and keeping people safer.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. With me on the telephone tonight is Redwood City Attorney Nafiz Ahmed. We're talking about driving under the influence cases. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you may call regarding any question on the topic. Tonight's topic is driving under the influence. You don't have to limit yourself to whatever point we may be in the conversation. Again, if you're outside of San Francisco, our number is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to walk somebody through a first-time DUI case. What's their experience going to be like? But before we get there, we've already received a question.
Sure.
Why not level the playing field and require all cars to have these interlock devices? Wouldn't we all be safer?
Oh, that's a great one. Yeah, totally. I mean, that would be, it's almost like such a good idea. You wonder why it hasn't happened already.
Now, we know lawyers might lose a little business, but wouldn't ultimately that be the ultimate safety, is to make sure that nobody can start or drive their car if they've been drinking?
I mean, that would be a fantastic way to, you know, go about it. Yeah, sure, it'd be a little bit inconvenient. You know, what if, you know, there was a sensor in the car where you don't necessarily have to blow into it, but it could detect whether through, they call it through the ambient air, basically air that's being exhaled through your body, whether there's alcohol in it. And what if, you know, instead of having to blow into a cumbersome device, it could just sense, you know, whether there's alcohol coming from the driver. Then, of course, the big question is, so what? It's legal to drive, you know, with a below a .08 as long as you're not, you know, drunk driving. I don't know if the technology is good enough to, I don't know, have that idea that I was thinking of working. But, yeah, sure, theoretically, having the device in everyone's car would keep everyone safer, yes.
So if either we limited the level to a 0.00 drinking and driving, a 0.00, or alternatively have some device that triggers at some lower level or near the legal limit that can be calibrated to 0.00 if somebody's under these conditions. It might work, but it's, I would imagine, an expense. What do these devices cost for people to have, if you know?
I know what it costs to put it in the car. I mean, you rent it from the companies that install it. And so, like, for example, there's a company out there, you know, that'll charge a flat rate of $77 a month with a $50 initial administrative fee. Most first offenders are either going to have the ignition interlock device on their car for 6 months or a total of 10 months. So, you know, whatever the math is on that, you know, 6 times 77 plus initial 50 or 10 times 77 plus initial 50, that's roughly, you know, the cost for putting on one of these devices.
So roughly speaking, for 6 months, it's going to cost somebody in the neighborhood of $500. So for some folks, it could be a barrier to driving just to pay for these devices.
Right. Yeah, correct.
Let me turn it over to Kyle in Oakland. Kyle, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding DUI laws with respect to cannabis.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
So I got a ticket for DUI. I was speeding on Highway 580. I'm charged with a DUI, but not with speeding, not for the speeding. And the courts there are just telling me to check back in two weeks, and this has been going on for 2 months. And I'm wondering what's going on.
So, Alameda County, the DA's office, is generally known for taking a while to file criminal charges on a misdemeanor DUI. Now, a misdemeanor DUI is meaning if you have less than 3 DUIs in 10 years, or you have a DUI injury, okay, the DA has, the DA being the district attorney, up to file the DUI charges against you.
Now, Fez, if you could state that again, we had a little technical glitch and lost you for a couple of seconds along the way.
Sure. Sorry about that. So,
I heard that about non-injury and you haven't had more than 3 in 10 years, and that's where you cut out.
Right. So, the prosecutor, which is the district attorney, in that situation has 1 year from the date of the DUI arrest to file charges, DUI charges against you as the driver. And in Alameda County, it's definitely not unusual for the prosecutor to wait, you know, several months. We're talking about even 6 months or longer before the charges are filed. So I don't think that that's unusual in the caller's case. It sounded almost like he just had the DUI just a few months ago. It's been a couple months, I think he said.
And they end up charging pressing charges anyway, or do they drop it after that in general, or?
Well, Kyle, I can answer that one, and the answer is there's no answer because we don't know how long it's been or what's come across their desk. They're still reviewing it or are still waiting for things to come to them from maybe from the lab. It may be further investigation they've asked of the officers, or it may be that it's sitting in a pile on somebody's desk. But they do have a while to look it over and figure out what's going on. On the other hand, if evidence is unavailable because it's been too long, then even within the year, if your attorney can assist you to show actual prejudice in the delay, then you may have an issue that would result in your case being dismissed, or certainly to bring them to the table to offer you some reduction.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much. That's very helpful.
Kyle, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. Now, as one thing Kyle brought up is the idea of a substance that's now legal can still result in a DUI charge. We know about alcohol, of course, and he brought up marijuana. Are there other substances that occasionally will lead to a DUI, even though the substances themselves are legal?
Yeah, I mean, what about NyQuil? NyQuil is completely legal, and so are a whole bunch of prescription medications like Sudafed, you know. The law is very clear that you cannot drive under the influence of alcohol or any drug, and the drug could be a legal drug, like we're talking about. And you cannot drive in a state that you're impaired, you know, from that, you know, alcohol or drug.
And of course, the laws define a drug as anything that can impair you. It doesn't have to be a medication. It seems to me, if I recall correctly, some recent counties were prosecuting things such as Cavitee, which sounds a little absurd, but if you ingest enough to affect your ability to operate a vehicle with the ordinary care and prudence of somebody not so impaired, who's to say?
Yeah, I mean, there's a case, there's a lawyer down in Santa Barbara, Daryl Jenis, I think, who had a case like that with Cavitee, and that was, you know, maybe about 10 years or so ago or more now. But yeah, it made the news, and those prosecutions do happen.
Let me turn it over to William in Albany. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. William, are you still with us? William, if we can't hear you, so if you are, if you're not on the line, feel free to call us back. It appears that we've lost your call. While we're waiting for William to call back or for our future callers, you're listening to Your Legal Rights. Tonight, we're discussing driving under the influence. With me on the phone tonight is Redwood City Attorney Nafiz Ahmed. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 in the studio. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on the topic of driving under the influence. You are not limited to the point we may be in the conversation. I do see a call coming back. I don't know if it's William calling back or not. But, Nafiz, we have about 7 minutes before we break briefly. Talk a little bit about what the experience is like and what people can do to protect themselves if you, in fact, get pulled over and are accused of driving under the influence.
Well, in terms of the experience, I'm going to explain what the driver's likely to face, which is upon getting pulled over, an officer will be usually approaching their driver's side of their vehicle, depending upon traffic conditions, and maybe safer to approach from the passenger side. If it's at nighttime, expect to have, a flashlight being shown or shined in your general direction to make sure that you don't have any weapons or anything that could harm the officer. And the cop's usually going to be asking you, after a few questions, after, license and registration, have you been drinking or have you had anything to drink tonight? And that's usually one of the questions that if you give an answer to is going to, cause an issue in the defense of your case down the road. Now, one thing that most people don't know is the questions that the officer asks you after you get pulled over for a DUI, in large part, or on suspicion of a DUI, in large part, you don't have to answer. So you don't have to answer questions like, have you been drinking? You don't have to say yes or no. Where are you coming from? Where are you going? You don't have to answer anything. The cop may tell you, because you've been drinking, I want to have you do some field sobriety tests or a few exercises, they may say.
So before you get there, is there any reason these drivers shouldn't say, well, my lawyer, Nafiz Ahmed, told me I shouldn't answer your questions? I, respect your authority, but Mr. Ahmed is an authority, and he's told me not to talk to you.
Yeah. In fact, it's in their best interest to do so, and I think, I really like your business cards. Think that if people had, more of them, if there are more of them around, they'd be able to hand that card to the officer and say, look,
What card do you mean?
there's a card, I think, where you have all your rights. I respectfully refuse to, you know, answer any of your questions, officer. I respectfully refuse to do any tests. You know, and I think in your card does say you'll do the, there's a mandatory test you have to do, you know, after you're arrested. But before you're arrested, so these field sobriety tests or even blowing into a machine, you know, at the roadside, you don't have to do that for the most part on any DUI.
Let me interrupt you for a moment, though. Besides taking an incoming call, I just want to clarify one thing, and that is if you are already on probation for a DUI, what NAFIS is telling you now may not apply to you about not having to believe it. So definitely, if you are on probation or if you are accepting a plea to a DUI, talk to your attorney about whether you need to comply with those tests. We're about to break. Before we do, I'd like to try to fit one more call in. Caitlin, welcome. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Hi there. I just actually wanted to piggyback, and he was leading into it, about a refusal of questions. And so what we had happened with a friend of ours is they did refuse, and they said based on their driving behavior, they were still arrested. And additionally, they were charged with an additional refusal as well. So I was wondering if you could speak about that.
So, Caitlin, the police could choose to arrest the driver based on, you know, their observations of the driver. Basically, if the cop thinks that there's probable cause to believe that the driver was driving impaired, the cop could arrest the driver. Now, probable cause is, you know, pretty low standard. It's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Probable cause just means would a reasonable person in the officer's position, you know, with his or her, you know, experience, think that the crime of driving under the influence has occurred. You know, and generally the cops, you know, even if the driver refuses to answer all questions, will probably say, I saw bloodshot and watery eyes on the driver. I smelled the odor of alcohol coming from them. Usually the cops will have the person get out of the car, you know, as an officer of safety issue, or just to even observe how the driver does get out of the car. Are they, you know, steady on their feet? Are they using the door to brace, you know, themselves to get out? Like, all the observations that the officer can make, even without getting a single response from the driver, the officer can use that, you know, to say it had probable cause to arrest, okay? Now, in terms of the refusal that your friend had, after the individual is arrested, they must submit to a blood or breath test in certain circumstances. You know, well, it was blood or breath test, okay? If the driver doesn't submit to the blood or breath test, you know, there's really stiff consequences. You know, even on a first DUI, it's a one-year time period where your license would be suspended and you wouldn't have the ability to get a restricted license. And one thing I wanted to point out, Jeff pointed out a caution for people. If you're on probation, hey, you have to submit to a breath test, you know, roadside. For those folks out in Marin County, you know, the police use what they call an evidential test, a Draeger, a portable breath testing device, where you have to do that test. And even if it's roadside, for those folks out in Marin County, if the cops are going to arrest you for a DUI, you know, you've got to submit to the test after arrest. Otherwise, you could be facing a refusal and at least a one-year license suspension.
So, Caitlin, in short, Caitlin, what NAFIS is saying is that before your friend could be charged with the refusal that enhances the penalty for the DUI, he or she had to refuse the blood or breath test after arrest. If your friend was already on probation, then it may have been enough to refuse the breath test on the side of the road. Otherwise, you're talking about the ultimate blood or breath test before you could face an enhanced penalty for refusal. Now, they may use the word refusal to say, we don't like the fact that they didn't talk to me or that they didn't get up and walk the line or whatever other tests that the officer wanted your friend to give. But that's really a question of whether you want to submit to giving the evidence to the other side or not. Do you want to really be in a position where they've taken a good look at you?
Can I add one thing in there, too?
You can take about 30 seconds.
Sure. Your friend really wants to hire an attorney because the refusal enhancement's really stiff. The cops, in order to basically prove the refusal, they need to read like a whole bunch of admonitions about how your license could be suspended if you don't give the test. If they didn't read the admonitions correctly, your friend may be able to get out of the refusal enhancement and avoid the license suspension.
Caitlin, thank you for joining us. We're going to take a break for just a moment. If you have additional questions, stay on the line with us. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
And we're back. And NAFAs, before we broke, you and I discussed things such as NyQuil or Cavitee, and we were asked the question, how can drivers be tested for such things as Cavitee or NyQuil?
Well, definitely with NyQuil, you know, there's going to be a certain amount of alcohol that's going to show up in a blood test, or even if there was a urine test, the officer suspected drugs. With the Cavitee, you know, I haven't had one of those cases. I'm not even sure if that's going to show up on a breath test. I'm assuming that that's probably going to be one of those impaired driving charges. So maybe not, you know, a 0.08 or greater type of charge, but one of those deals where the cops saw bad driving and they're getting prosecuted for bad driving. And maybe there's a blood test that gets taken and it shows up in a blood test or even a urine test. Those would probably be the ways that, you know, the prosecutor's case would proceed against the driver in that situation.
And in the case of something like NyQuil, you've got alcohol inside that they can test for. But other substances, if the driver doesn't submit to a blood or urine test, is it pretty much an observation of symptoms and what the officer can get somebody to admit?
No, I didn't really understand the question. Can you say it one more time, Jeff, or a little bit differently?
I'll say it in plain language, which sometimes eludes me. With something like NyQuil, obviously they're testing for alcohol.
Right.
For some chemicals, they regularly screen them in a urine test or a blood test. For right. something like Cavitee, aren't they pretty much limited to what the person admits and what they observe in terms of symptoms?
I'm basically understanding your question. Like, are they limited to what the cop observes? I mean, if they do a blood test, right? I mean, if I think I am understanding you correctly, let's say the cop, you know, thinks that the person's under the influence of something, right? You know, and they think it's either alcohol or alcohol or drugs. The cop's probably going to ask the driver to submit to a blood test, okay? And in that scenario, what ends up happening is a blood test will get drawn, and then there's going to be a lab that analyzes the blood sample, and it's going to report its finding back to the prosecution, and they're going to say, these are the substances that we found, and if there are even any substances in the blood, and then the prosecutor could decide to file charges based on whatever, you know, was found in the driver's blood. Does that answer the question? Was that what you were looking for?
To my satisfaction, it does. To our listeners, if you feel otherwise and you would like to have a better answer to that question, you're welcome to call in and see if you can articulate it better than I did. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden, and with me on the program tonight is Redwood City Attorney Nafiz Ahmed. Tonight, we're talking about driving under the influence. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on the topic. The topic tonight is driving under the influence cases. You're not limited to the point we may be in the conversation. Any questions you have, again, if you're outside of San Francisco, that's 866-798-8255. Where we left off before the break was we were just starting to talk about the experience somebody would have if they got pulled over for a suspected DUI. Can you pick up where we left off?
Yeah, so I think we're talking about how, you know, the cop's going to approach the driver, you know, and probably within a few questions ask if they've been drinking. And, you know, that's usually the big one. And usually from there, you know, the cop's going to do what they call a finger test, you know, on the eyes. It's really, there's a technical name to this, you know, eye test. But yeah, I'm sure you've seen it on TV, you know, follow my finger with your eyes without moving your head, right? That's probably one of the first tests that you're going to see the cop do right there while the driver's seated in the driver's seat. Now, technically, the officer is supposed to pull the driver out of the car and have him do that test. It's not a scientifically valid if the driver's still seated in the car, but you see it happen all the time. And usually after that test, you know, the cop's going to decide, hey, I'm going to either pull this driver out of the car or I'm going to, you know, let him go about their merry way. And then usually after they pull him out of the car, go through a series of questions, and there's 21 questions that the officer has to ask the driver, like, where were you coming from? Where were you going? Do you know of anything mechanically wrong with your car? Are you sick or injured? A whole bunch of questions. Because all these questions, you know, will be used, or the responses by the driver will be used against the driver later in court if they're going to, you know, challenge whether or not they're guilty of the DUI. And after the officer asks, you know, these series of questions, the officer will have the driver perform these tests that I was telling you about earlier, which are not mandatory. They are, you know, the field sobriety test or exercise test, you know, like walking a line and holding your leg up, keeping it there, or, you know, keeping your hands at your side with your head tilted back and your eyes closed, and similar exercise types of tests. And after, you know, the driver does all these tests, you know, the cop will say, hey, look, you know, I want you to blow into this device. Now, the cop's supposed to read an admonition to the driver, and this is the thing that I was telling you guys earlier. This test before arrest is not mandatory. And theoretically, the cop's supposed to tell the driver, look, I'm requesting that you, you know, submit to this breath test, but it's not mandatory. You have the right to, you know, not submit to it. Although it's very, you know, interesting, you know, now that we have body cam videos, meaning body camera videos that the officers wear, we're seeing quite a, you know, quite a number of cases that the cops don't need the admonition, and they just say, blow into this device. And, you know, the people end up doing it, even though this is a test that they don't have to do. Usually following blowing into the device, the driver gets arrested, and then they get read the admonition about, hey, now that you've been arrested, you have to do this, you know, blood or breath test. Which one do you pick? And that in a nutshell, you know, the DUI arrest, at least the beginning part of it.
I see multiple calls that are starting to get backed up. Please be patient. You're on your way through to us right now. So we've talked about some of the roadside tests, and it's your advice that somebody shouldn't necessarily participate in the test any more than the questioning?
Well, I mean, I didn't give an opinion on that yet, but if I were to give an opinion on it, look, you know, if you've been drinking and you know you've been drinking, I would definitely do the bare minimum that you'd have to do. You have to turn over your license, your registration, proof of insurance. Okay, if the officer asks you to get out of the car, they have the legal right to do so. They don't need any reason other than I just want you to. Okay, the cop wants you out of the car, get out of the car. They want to ask you, you know, questions. I would say, hey, look, respectfully, officer, I refuse to answer any questions without my attorney present. If you don't say those magic words about I won't answer questions without my attorney present. Theoretically, anything that you say, you know, can still be used against you in evidence, unless you specifically say, I'm invoking my right to a lawyer and I'm invoking my right to remain silent. All your responses are going to get used against you. For example, you know, the cop says, I want you to do these tests. And you say, no, I won't. I won't do it. That statement there will be used against you in court. So you have to be very specific. You know, I, you know, will refuse to talk to you without my lawyer present, you know, and I refuse to do any tests without, you know, my attorney.
Be polite, but be assertive, but be polite, because ultimately these people have an awful lot of power over you. But also you want to be unequivocal, so don't say we weren't sure what you wanted. But let me interrupt you. I'd like to turn it over to Cindy in Oakland. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. You just answered my question. I was trying to find out what's the prudent thing to do if you're stopped by the cops at a, like, a, they've got a checkpoint sometimes on holidays, you know? And I think you just answered it, actually. Like, don't admit, you know, well, I only had one beer or something like that.
Yeah, you know, one beer usually means at least two. And so no admissions would be the appropriate way to go. Like, if you're at a checkpoint and the police are going to pull you out of a checkpoint for a random screening, I think what's best to do in that scenario is to respectfully say, I refuse to answer any questions without my attorney present, and I refuse to do any of your tests, okay? At that point, the police will probably arrest you, but at least the good thing is there's going to be less bad evidence that will be able to be used against you later in court.
Cindy, there's an old adage amongst defense attorneys. I saw this for the first time as a public defender some 25 years ago. There's a number of people that when they get arrested, they tell the police, yes, I've been drinking, but only two beers. And invariably, we know of this because they become our clients. So typically, do people say two beers, two Budweisers, that one of the longest standing, one of the great attorneys that really developed this area of law used to have on his emails a little saying at the bottom that says, friends, don't let friends drink Bud.
Yeah. You know, a few years ago, my husband, we were pulled over, it was New Year's or something, and he was driving, and he says, yeah, I had a beer. And they're like, why did you do that? And he has MS, and he has nystagmus in his eyes. So it's like, he did not get arrested, but...
You're kind of in a bad spot once you start that conversation, because if you say you've been drinking, you've admitted to drinking, now it's a question of how much, and you've started down that road. If you deny drinking, they smell alcohol, you're clearly not being honest with them, and again, you've started your way down that road. The safest thing, as Naf has said, is... on advice of my attorney, I'm respectfully, you know, not answering these questions.
Yeah.
But you know what's hard, though, is when you do that, right, the cop's technically not supposed to ask you any more questions, you know, after that. But the hard thing is when the cops come back at you and they start telling you things like, well, you don't have the right to have an attorney present before we do, you know, breath tests. Are you going to do the test or not? And then people start getting confused, you know, about, well, what should I do? You know, and there's a lot of pressure that happens. So it's really not easy, you know, as the driver, because there's a lot of rules that you guys need to know about what your rights are. And it's kind of too voluminous to explain right now. I mean, I can try, but they put a lot of pressure on you. I think the safest thing to do is just make sure that you guys, you know, invoke your right to remain silent. Okay, not do any tests without your attorney present. If you do get arrested, you have to do a test post-arrest. Otherwise, you know, be prepared to facing minimum of a 1-year license suspension. Okay, so some people do want to gamble and say, hey, look, I'll take a license suspension. If they don't have any evidence against me, I'll take my chances at trial that I could get, you know, found not guilty, you know. And some people do that. Of course, I can't ever suggest, you know, to do one thing or the other like that. I would just say, you know your rights and choose to exercise them the way you wish you want to or the way you think is best.
And remember that we're giving advice on what to do when you're already in the situation. We may talk of giving you the best advice on how to handle it, but the best advice at all is what we haven't said yet, and that's simply don't drink to excess and drive. And excess can be far, far less than people think. And with the level of alcohol at 0.08, it's very easy to slide across that line and not be aware of it. And with Lyft and Uber so readily available and so cheap, seriously think about that. There's talk of lowering the standard to a 0.04 or a 0.05. Personally, this is just me speaking, I'm all for it, because if people realize that the standard is that low, they're going to get it. But with a standard at 0.08, I think people can slide across and not know it. That's just me talking. Not because you may disagree.
No, you know, I mean, you bring up a really good point, which is like, people don't know exactly how many drinks it takes to get you to an 0.08. So some people may assume, look, it's going to take me, you know, quite a few. I mean, I think a good number of people know, you know, generally, you know, through drink equivalents, right? If I have one Budweiser, right, that, you know, as a man, you know, about 160 pounds, not myself, but I mean, about 160 pounds, that's about, you know, enough to bring you up to about a 0.02 blood alcohol level. So some guys may think, hey, I can have, you know, about 4 beers and, you know, be about the limit or, you know, under it, because I'm heavier than 160 pounds. But it's fuzzy because, you know, not everybody's drinking, you know, Budweiser, and the amount of time period that you're drinking it, the beer. I mean, you may be drinking something like an IPA that's got a much higher alcohol content, and you may be drinking more than 12 ounces when you're drinking the beer. And so you may think, oh, I could drink 4 beers and still, you know, blow below 0.08, but in reality, you may only be able to drink 3, or even, you know, may, as crazy as it sounds, only even a couple, depending upon your particular situation, get you to, you know, a 0.08. And I find, especially for my female clients, because, you know, men and women, they metabolize alcohol differently. The female clients could get up to an 0.08 much more quickly than, you know, they would imagine. I mean, usually a couple drinks, you know, for the ladies, that might be enough.
I'm going to cut us short because we're starting to get backed up with calls and time's running short. But Cindy, thank you for joining us.
And thank you.
And when in doubt, remember, folks, ride shares are cheap. Well, let me turn it over to Alex in Berkeley. You're welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hi, welcome.
Alex.
You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, so my question is, in regards to, like weed, if an officer stops you and he smells it, what's your like, he smells it in the car, what's your probability of getting a DUI if, like, one, weed is legal, and I know, like, alcohol is also legal, but, like, if you haven't smoked, or, and it's just the smell, because, you know, like,
so
if you do a blood test and you smoked like a week before, like it's gonna come up since the substance is like that.
Okay, so you have two questions in there. Starting with the first one, are you talking about the officer smelling unburnt marijuana? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I mean, if you smell an unburnt marijuana, then, you know, what's the reason to be arresting you for a DUI? I mean, there's certain rules regarding, you know, driving with marijuana in the vehicle and how it has to be stored in a sealed package, okay? So you may be getting a citation, you know, for transporting marijuana, you know, outside of the rules or in violation of the rules. But, I mean, getting a DUI for the cops smelling unburnt marijuana, that doesn't really make much sense. In terms of your other question, the testing that they can do, you know, for detecting marijuana, they can tell based upon marijuana and its metabolites, generally, you know, whether or not the drug was psychoactive in your system at the time that, you know, you took the test. After, you know, I think the prosecution's experts will say, you know, about 5-6 hours or so, you know, the psychoactive portion of the marijuana is not, you know, really going anymore. And so they can tell based on, not to make it too complicated, the amount of metabolite of marijuana that's in your system, whether or not it was active or not. And there's certain numbers that correspond to that. And so they can generally tell if you smoked a week ago, right, assuming that, you know, you're a heavy, you know, marijuana user, yeah, it may show up in the system, but they can tell if you smoke generally recently or if it's, you know, marijuana that's just old. So it's nothing to be concerned about too much unless you smoke, you know, recent in relation to the driving.
Right. Okay, okay. That makes sense.
As time goes All on, right. I think it's not that far off that they will have standards for how much THC in your system actually makes you impaired to the point where you can't exercise the caution, the prudence and caution of somebody who's not impaired. And right now we don't have that standard.
Right, yeah, yeah. That's why I was asking, because it's like pretty unclear whether, you know, it's still not pretty certain of whether you it's psychoactive at, or not at the moment you're
the
being
bottom
stopped.
Line is the cop's going to have you do some tests, you know, those exercise tests that we were talking about earlier. And if he doesn't like how you do the test, he's going to say, well, you weren't driving good because you were impaired by marijuana, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much everybody's not going to do good on those tests. So you really don't want the cops arresting you for DUI marijuana. And the amount that the prosecution's experts will say, you know, is enough to impair you is very low, okay, like really, really low. So even if you smoked a little bit, you know, within a few hours, they'll generally say that was enough to impair you.
Remember also, the advice that NAPFAS is giving you applies to somebody who's over 21. If you're under 21, all bets are off. Any amount at all can have an effect on your license. Any amount of alcohol can have an effect on your license, separate and apart from whether you're subject to prosecution.
Right, right. Yeah. All right, well, yeah, that was my question. Thank you guys for having me, or for giving me the space.
Alex, thank you for joining us. You're welcome back anytime. Your legal rights. Let me turn it to Stan in San Francisco. You're on your legal rights.
Hi. I recently sat on a jury for a DUI, and several years ago for a DUI previously as well. And I'm wondering what how does somebody reduce their penalties or whatever by taking their chance at trial? Or because the reason I ask is that the prosecution seems to stack charges. They'll say driving over 0.08, and then they'll say wanton intent, and in one case they said lying to the police officer whether or not they were drinking or whatever, which I think is a BS charge, and another was reckless driving on the other case.
Right. Well, first off, Sam, thank you for your jury service. Based on the charges, it almost sounds like you were in a jury in San Francisco. Is that right?
Yeah, I was. Both times.
Yeah. The charge of lying to the cops about how much you've been drinking, that's a San Francisco thing that they started doing a few years back. Not many counties do that. You know, like that, and that pops up when, you know, the cop says, how much have you been drinking? And like Jeff was saying, 2 beers. And then it turns out, you know, you had such a high blood alcohol level that it's impossible to have gotten there with 2 beers, and now the DAs are throwing on this charge of giving false information to the police. I mean, that's a crazy one. But to answer your question, does going to a trial help you reduce your charges? And I think the very, very simple and clear answer is it's a win or lose proposition. You win, you get out of the penalties. You lose, mm-hmm. You go down, and you probably go down harder than if you didn't go to trial and if you had just taken a deal, you know, before trial.
Yeah, I saw charges getting stacked is what I was my observation.
Yeah, and, you know, the reason that the prosecutor would do that is to make it more likely that the person's going to go down on at least one charge. You know, and then if they do, then there's punishment there. So it's just to help ensure, you know, the likelihood of success, you know, from the prosecutor's position.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for that.
Stan, thank you for joining us. And again, welcome back anytime on your legal rights. Now, as we're really at the near the end of the hour, I'd like to give you, you know, a minute, 2 minutes for any closing thoughts you have or anything you want to say in summary.
Well, you know, the closing thoughts are for everyone, you know, who unfortunately finds themselves stopped for a DUI, just remember to be respectful and courteous with the officer. Respectfully, you know, if you so choose, decline to answer, you know, any questions without your attorney present. And if you want to do so, respectfully choose to not do a roadside breath test. You've got to do one, you know, after arrest, blood or breath. And if you, you know, are arrested, then one thing that you have to do to try to protect your license is to request a hearing with the DMV, which is the Department of Motor Vehicles, within 10 days of your arrest. Otherwise, you're going to end up dealing with a license suspension. Now, a lot of my clients hire me within 10 days of their DUI arrest so that I can request a hearing for them and that they don't have to do it themselves. But somebody's got to request the hearing. Otherwise, the client's license is going to get suspended. You're going to want to, you know, be diligent and write down your version of events from the night while it's still fresh in your head. And you're going to want to be able to either give that, you know, written summary to an attorney or one that you hire, or, you know, to a public defender if you're going to use a court-appointed lawyer or a public defender later in court. And just remember, you know, the time, you know, that you're pulled over, the time for vindication is not then. It is later if you still want to, if you want to go that road. And just know that you're not a bad person if you get a DUI. There will be punishment if you are convicted of it. But, you know, with proper and good help, you know, the punishment could be something that doesn't necessarily have a terrible impact, you know, on your life.
The bottom line is, as an attorney, Nafez, you can do a lot of damage control.
Maybe, yeah.
And what you said about the vindication not coming that moment, don't make up crazy stories, because nothing you say that you think of in the 5 or 10 seconds you have to do so is going to make it all go away. Take a step back, respectfully ask for your attorney, don't take the tests, but always be polite. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. My guest tonight has been Redwood City Attorney Nafez Ahmed. Nafez is a certified as a criminal law specialist by the California Board of Legal Specialization, State Bar of California. And Nafez Ahmed, let me thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. It's always a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
We'll be back next week with Your Legal Rights. And next week, we will once again feature our Call a Lawyer Night. And again, thank you to Nafez Ahmed for joining us. And our thanks to you for listening. And thanks to our production assistant, Martin McLean. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Thank you for listening, and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.